What happens, do you suppose, when you stimulate an already stimulated economy, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, December the 8th, I believe. Glad you could be with us, as always, everybody. Economic stimulus in a bit. First, though, the transition team at Trump Tower made it official this morning. Scott Pruitt, the attorney general of Oklahoma, a climate change denier who has also sued the Environmental Protection Agency over its regulations on greenhouse gases and who is a close friend of the oil and gas industry, has been chosen to run the EPA. So handwriting on the wall, Tom, here. One can assume a Pruitt EPA will be a get-out-of-the-way EPA, one that would yield to market forces. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong explains where those forces are headed.
One target of the incoming administration is the EPA's power plant regulation. The Clean Power Plan pushes to burn less coal. But if you reject that plan for, we'll call it the free market power plan, you might get to the same place. Coal is losing out to cheap natural gas anyway, says consultant John Larson at the Rhodium Group.
One of the great ironies is that they may oversee a power sector that meets the same emission reduction outcomes as what the Clean Power Plan was going to require, solely because of market dynamics like cheap gas and cheap renewables.
That's his outlook for the next couple decades. We'll call that the midterm future. But long term, natural gas is still a carbon polluter. So deregulation on its own could accelerate climate change, says energy economist Michael Greenstone at the University of Chicago.
When one hears about, yes, we want to cut the cost for business today, they should also hear in the back of their mind, and I want to increase costs on society in the future by having more disruptive climate change. And that's the fundamental trade-off here.
The president-elect also wants to, quote, unleash the U.S. oil sector. The thing is, oil executive Ed Herz, also an economist at the University of Houston, says American drillers have been leashed by OPEC and low prices from oversupply. As for the EPA?
It really doesn't have any bearing on it. The government can be a cheerleader for crude oil production, but it's not going to change the market forces.
Any lifeline to industry would be thrown by the Saudis and the Russians, not Washington. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
All right, so there is in the Time Magazine Person of the Year profile of Donald Trump that dropped yesterday a passage that caught our eye. His line about the economy, and this is a quote, that sometimes you have to prime the pump in order to get jobs going and the country going, end of quote. That pump priming is also known as fiscal stimulus, hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts and infrastructure spending that the president-elect has promised to juice the economy. It's a lot like President Obama did when he took over, except right now, as opposed to then, our economy is reasonably pumped up already. So what happens if we try to pump it up more? From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
With unemployment down to 4.6%, Douglas Holtz Aiken at the Conservative American Action Forum says the U.S. economy doesn't really need much pump priming right now.
We're nearly back to full employment. We're somewhere in the vicinity. As a result, the sort of notion of stimulus getting you out of a recession back to full employment is pretty much in the rearview mirror.
But he says infrastructure spending could draw more people back into the labor force who aren't included in the unemployment rate right now, fixing roads and bridges, upgrading airports.
You will bring people back into the labor market for a while. If these investments make those workers more productive, you can drive up the wages without any threat of having to drive up prices as well.
Dean Baker at the Progressive Center for Economic and Policy Research also sees potential good in a public construction boom.
The gains are enormous. The people who will get those jobs really need them. People at the bottom end of the ladder, people who are disproportionately Hispanic, disproportionately African American.
But there are risks to spending more and cutting taxes, rising deficits, inflation, higher interest rates. And Rick Geddes of Cornell University, who studies infrastructure, says construction projects aren't just about laying asphalt and concrete. They're quite high tech.
They're very capital intensive. They use a lot of modern equipment that requires a high level of expertise to operate as opposed to a lot of workers.
So he says they're not such a great way to get less skilled workers back to work again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Surgeon General issued a report today on kids and e-cigarettes, calling vaping an emerging threat to the health of our youth. Vaping, it turns out, is getting more popular by the day. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
There are now more high school students than adults using e-cigarettes, according to the report. Surgeon General Vivek Morathi says that's a problem. He says e-cigs hurt developing brains because most contain nicotine, which is addictive.
And it also affects the capacity for attention and learning and increases susceptibility for mood disorders.
Morathi says he reached that conclusion after looking at studies on the effects of nicotine on people and animals. Still, Thomas Kicklis of the Tobacco Vapor E-Cig Association disagrees with the Surgeon General. He says nicotine is not harmful, and a regular cigarette is much more dangerous than an e-cig.
It's delivering nicotine in a vastly less harmful and safe product.
Howard Markell is a pediatrician and editor of the health policy journal Milbank Quarterly. He says e-cigarettes might help adults quit smoking, but why let kids get started on them?
If it was your child and some doctor told you we just don't have enough information, but it's probably better to be safe than sorry, what side would you take?
The spokesman for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Vince Wilmore, says e-cig makers are trying to appeal to young people in a number of ways,
including the use of sweet flavors and the use of marketing tactics, just like those that have been used to market regular cigarettes to kids.
Wilmore thinks other government agencies should take the Surgeon General's lead, ban sweet flavors for e-cigs and marketing to young people. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Another record day at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Couple of stories now. Well, actually, it's one story and an interview about globalization and organized labor, President-elect Trump's new American industrial policy and manufacturing and heavy industry in this country. It's been about a year and a half since a slew of iron ore mines were shut down in northern Minnesota, caught up in a big global steel downturn. Steel, of course, takes iron to make it. 2,000 people were laid off, some of them third and fourth, even fifth generation miners. Some of those people have been able to go back to work, but others are having to make backup plans for their futures. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker has our story.
Most mine workers on Minnesota's Iron Range will tell you they're used to the ups and downs of the industry. Tony Drazenovich works at the plant everyone calls Keetac, one of two Minnesota mines owned by U.S. Steel.
I've been laid off 7 times from Keetac in that 17 years, so that's a lot of layoffs.
But Drazenovich says most of those layoffs were short, not like this one. Cliff Toby is president of the local steelworkers union in Keewatin. The town borders Keetac's enormous open-pit mine that's several hundred feet deep. Toby says some workers, even those with long family connections to the Iron Range, have left.
I've even heard stories of members just dropping off their house keys at the bank and basically jumping in their cars and heading out.
But other laid-off miners, like Tony Drazenovich, have made a different choice. They've gone back to school through a federal program known as TAA, or Trade Adjustment Assistance. It pays to retrain workers who lost their jobs because of global trade.
I think they're just doing some torch work in here right now.
David Meyer points out students learning how to weld at Hibbing Community College, where he's studying industrial systems technology.
When we graduate, we have another set of skills of hard, dedicated employees that want to get a paycheck for their work.
Meyer helps tutor some of the students, including Kevin Maxey, who was laid off from a company called Mining Resources.
It's been a struggle. It's no lie. I do a lot of homework. Spend a lot of time looking at books.
Maxey's 51. This is actually his second time getting retrained. He got a 2-year degree in computer technology when he was laid off from a different company in 2009. But this is the first time he's had to take physics. He sometimes studies with his high school age daughter.
Oh, I've had to actually ask her help for algebra, you know, because she's right there and right about the same line I'm at, so.
Is that kind of humbling?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And she definitely lets me know, too, that really, Dad, that's easy. I'm like, not for me, it's not.
But Maxie's sticking it out and plans to graduate in May. He hopes to use his new degree to land a better job at one of the mines. But Meyer says most students are thinking of a plan B.
They want this training so that if the mine doesn't open up, they can go relocate. Because it really worries them about how non-dependable the feeling is in the industry.
U.S. Steel has given no indication of when or even if it plans to reopen Keewatin Taconite. The company initially idled the plant because of low steel prices and a surge of imports. That included steel the U.S. says was illegally sold here at less than what it cost China and other countries to make it. In a statement, U.S. Steel says those factors continue to have an impact, even though the federal government has imposed some steep tariffs. Tony Barrett, an economist at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth, says unemployed mine workers are in a tough spot.
You give up hope that it's going to reopen, you retrain yourself, you're going to get another job, but it won't be like that. And in rural America, you don't get many jobs that pay $60,000 to $80,000 a year like those do.
Barrett says the best hope for mine workers on the Iron Range is if President-elect Trump imposes additional tariffs on imported steel. In Hibbing, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
Let's stay on those two themes here for a second, Donald Trump and steel. The president-elect spent some time on Twitter last night going after the president of the Steelworkers Union local in Indianapolis, Indiana. Chuck Jones is his name. He's a critic of the deal that Trump brokered with Carrier. And the president-elect hit Jones with the following tweet last night, quote, Chuck Jones, who is president of United Steelworkers 1999, has done a terrible job representing workers. No wonder companies flee country. To see how that's playing out in the Hoosier State, we've got James Briggs from the Indianapolis Star back on the phone. James, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, Chuck Jones and his interactions, I guess you'd say, with the president-elect. How's that playing actually in Indianapolis?
Yeah, well, I think Chuck Jones has a lot of support in Indianapolis. Regardless of what people think about his politics, he's had a big presence in the community, particularly as people he represents have been getting laid off. Even Governor Mike Pence tweeted about Chuck Jones a few months ago, saying he's glad to be working with people like Chuck Jones to save jobs in Indiana.
To that point about jobs in Indiana, it turns out that it's not quite the 1,100 jobs that Mr. Trump said were going to be saved at that Carrier plant, right?
Yeah, that number that they announced last week was a little bit misleading. And one of the biggest reasons it was misleading is because the company several months ago had already said it was keeping 300 jobs, engineering jobs, research and development jobs in Indiana. So when the company announced that it was staying last week, it basically lumped those into the jobs that were being saved in addition to that and came out with a number that was 1,069. But as far as new jobs saved, the number is more like 800.
There was also, just to close the loop on the Carrier thing, the $7 million in state incentives. You and your colleagues at the Star have reported that the state's probably going to make a lot of that money back, right, on taxes and worker salaries and all that stuff.
Yeah, the incentives were a little bit more than the state usually spends on these types of things, but it wasn't unheard of. The state will probably come out okay in that regard. Obviously, people are going to continue working and receiving income, and they'll be paying that money back in taxes. And it wasn't an exorbitant amount of money for the state to spend in incentives.
For lack of a better word, what's the vibe in Indianapolis as that city and this company and its workers get all of this attention?
Well, I think that the answer to that probably falls along partisan lines, as so many things do. But I think you saw a lot of appreciation for Donald Trump and the deal that he reached last week. Certainly, no matter how you criticize this deal, and there are ways that you can, 700 plus people are keeping their jobs who thought that for the last 9 months they were going to be laid off. People in this community are thankful for that intervention by the incoming Trump administration. But at the same time, a lot of people also are very skeptical, not only because Indiana is putting incentive money toward that deal, but also because, economists and others have rightly pointed out that's not necessarily a sustainable economic development model to negotiate one factory at a time to save jobs.
Yeah, and in fact, you and your colleagues at the Star have pointed out that with other companies in Indianapolis shedding jobs, something like 2,100 more jobs are going to be leaving that state from Indianapolis, right?
Yeah, in addition to Carrier, there are at least seven other companies that are planning to outsource jobs in the coming months, including layoffs that are still going to happen at Carrier. That number is about 2,100, as far as our research can show.
James Briggs is a business reporter. He's a columnist as well at the Indianapolis Star. James, thanks very much.
Thank you.
coming up.
They have innovative new designs. U.S. greenbacks are pretty prosaic.
And most definitely not going to win the award for best banknote. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 65 points today, about 0.3%, 19,614 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 23 points, 0.4%, 5417. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%, ended at 22.46. As we told you earlier, Surgeon General says e-cigarettes are a health threat for young people, not something that big tobacco companies wanted to hear. They make some of the top-selling e-cig brands. Reynolds America off 0.2% today. Altria stayed pretty much flat, though. Good day to be in the clothing business, though. Lululemon, maker of those yoga pants, reported a sales bump of 13% from last year, sending shares up a limber 15%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.40%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker, do you think that this technology has saved you?
I'm probably alive because of it, but I don't know. I think it's probably saved me physically, but I think spiritually it probably bankrupted me.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The holidays of late have not been kind to UPS. Last year, after Cyber Monday, its ground package on-time delivery rate fell to 91%, which, while seemingly good, stinks if your holiday package was in the 9% that didn't get where it was supposed to go. This year's numbers are, of course, still TBD, but UPS expects to deliver a record 700 million packages between Thanksgiving and New Year's Eve. And the company says it's ready, software gods willing. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
When Nafis Muhammad first started driving for UPS 8 months ago, he had a hard time keeping up. Like all UPS drivers, he had a lot on his plate. He would get his packages, plus their addresses and promised delivery times, and he'd have to plan out a route that got him back to the delivery center in a standard 8.5-hour workday.
If you don't know your area, you're not doing it in 8.5 hours. You're doing it in 10, and they're like, let's go, step it up.
He eventually got faster. Then, a few months ago, his delivery center started using a software program that tells him, one by one, what order to deliver the packages in.
So that makes your job 10 times easier.
The program is called Orion, the On-Road Integrated Optimization and Navigation System. At its heart is a complicated algorithm that crunches the data on the packages for a given route on a given day to come up with the most cost-effective order of delivery. Jack Levis managed the development of Orion.
For each route, it looks at about 200,000 different options on how that route could be run, and then says, here's the one I would use that I think is the most efficient.
Levis says the most efficient route isn't always the best for business. It might, for instance, deliver packages to regular customers at a different time every day.
Customers like consistency.
That's why UPS built Orion with a unique feature. It allows managers to adjust individual routes so they're more consistent.
It can handle adjustments to the timing of the stops that accommodate customers' preference for wanting it between a certain time window.
Satish Jindal is president of ShipMatrix, which monitors on-time delivery rates for shipping companies like UPS. He says Orion also incorporates UPS safety rules, like avoiding left turns. With Orion in place, a driver's morning starts at a computer screen that shows a list of stops plotted out on a map.
This is such an important part of their day because this gives them the information, starting with, how am I supposed to drive to my route?
At a delivery center in New Jersey, UPS business manager Douglas Sabara clicks on Muhammad's route.
At 9:51, he's going to be at 225 River Drive to deliver a next day air. He's got one piece for the stop. Tells him where it's loaded in the truck.
The stops come quickly, 9:51, 9:54, 9:57. There's little room for error. And that can be a problem, because one of Orion's limitations is that it doesn't recalculate for unexpected delays once drivers are out in the field. In those cases, they end up having to play catch-up. That becomes clear when I go for a ride-along with Muhammad. He just walked out of the truck and walked up the steps of a house. He's knocking on the door, waiting for somebody to answer, holding a package under his arm. He spends almost a minute and a half just standing there. Finally, a woman opens the door. He gives her the package, hurries back, and starts up the truck. I ask him if that lost him time.
A little bit, but that's why I always keep a good steady pace no matter what. But if I'm not moving as efficiently, then that would hurt me.
Jack Levis says UPS plans to release a new version of Orion that does recalculate by 2018. But even as it is, he says the software program is already on track to save UPS 100 million miles a year.
Which is why we didn't wait for all these final things. We said, you know, this is enough that we can make an impact to the business.
Levis says the software will also save $300 to $400 million a year in fuel and personnel costs. Those savings are crucial for UPS, which has to keep its prices down to compete for business from online retailers. But around the holidays, it may be the time savings that matter most. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up on the end of the year, which means naturally there are some awards to be given out, movies, music, also money. Yes, money. James Tarmy is a reporter at Bloomberg. His most recent piece is called The Oscars of Paper Currency. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, there is an award for the best banknote. Who knew?
Yes, there is indeed. It's the award given by the International Banknote Society, and it's been handed out since 2004 or so.
And it's worth a note here that the United States has never won, should we just say?
No. The United States isn't trying very hard, if you ask me.
just look at the money, man.
Seriously, the banknotes that win every year are colorful. They have innovative new designs. They have new security features. U.S. greenbacks are pretty prosaic.
So you know how in the actual Oscars you can say, well, it's a great script or there was great acting or the director was amazing. What does the International Banknote Society look for when it is judging the winners?
Well, first I have to say that it is explicitly a popularity contest.
Oh, yeah, totally. Well, so are the Oscars, but that's, you know, that's neither here nor there.
That's exactly right. You know, the thing is that there are various security features that everyone seems to be enchanted by in the International Banknote Society. Polymer banknotes, obviously, are the place where the majority of innovation is occurring.
Right, the new plasticky ones, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And those aren't without their own hiccups. But,
right,
you know, security features in terms of windows, which is to say the actual clear parts of the banknotes.
Like,
yes.
Like see-through clear?
See-through clear.
Wow.
In fact, the Australia $5 note has a top-to-bottom window feature, which is the first of its kind. And that $5 note is up in the running for best bill of 2016.
All right, so not to get on Queen Elizabeth's case here, but you got some picture of the queen, you got a couple of birds, and then what is it about the Australian fiver that makes it special? I guess it's that security feature.
It's that security feature. It's also the colors involved, honestly.
Which are pretty nice, right? There's a good hue there.
There's a kind of lovely, rich pink,
that's right,
light purple. The thing is that people respond, apparently, to colors. And this is something that Dennis Lutz, the president of the International Banknote Society, told me explicitly. They like flashier bills.
Should one have a favorite banknote? Does the International Banknote Society take nominations from the public? I mean, what are we supposed to do?
You've got to sign up to nominate. But any member of the International Banknote Society can nominate a note. What's interesting, though, is that apparently everyone sort of seems to have the same idea. The president of the society told me that, you know, once the first two or three notes are in the clear lead, it never changes.
Interesting. Much like the actual Oscars.
It is effectively the same thing insofar as it's a bunch of industry insiders who all have the same kind of general reference points and prejudices and background. And so it stands to reason that they would all prefer the same thing.
This is one of those radio stories that works best in print, to be honest with you. You got to see these bills to appreciate them. The piece is in Bloomberg. It's called The Oscars of Paper Currency by James Tarmy. James, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
As I said, you're going to want to see those bills. You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a quick follow to our coverage yesterday of the conflicts of interest that President-elect Trump will present once he takes office. The Wall Street Journal dug into the story today, focusing on how complicated the president-elect's corporate structures are. For just one example involving a helicopter, Trump, the Journal reports, and this is a quote, has a revocable trust that owns 99% of a Delaware limited liability company, that owns 99% of another Delaware LLC, that owns a Scottish limited company, that owns another Scottish company, that owns the 26-year-old Sikorsky S-76 Bravo helicopter, emblazoned with a red Trump on the side of its fuselage, end of quote. Got it now? All right, we got a boogie. The Dow up 65 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 23 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.